home to my loving family. What more could a man ask for?
Hi, Homer. Don't kiss me. I'm all stuffed up.
Oh, you know that feeling when you sound terrible, you feel terrible, you can't breathe through your nose, yet somehow it's running, your throat is sore, your brain becomes a cloud fog, you've got no energy, the cough sets in. Oh, I've just given myself chills thinking about it. The dreaded common cold, which you might often just shrug off as a, oh, well, it's just a cold. But is it? And when does it actually become far more serious and sometimes deadly? It's cousin, the flu. Let's talk about this in our regular chat with the Hunter Medical Research Institute. Today, we're catching up with Associate Professor Nathan Bartlett. He's a virologist with a special interest in this area. Good morning.
Good morning, Kaya.
Now is a good time to be talking about cold and flu.
Oh, it certainly is.
You're in the heart of research time.
It is. This is prime cold and flu season, so there's a lot going on in the area.
Let's start with the big question. What is the difference between a cold and a flu?
Well, really, cold and flu describes a spectrum of the disease, which at the mildest end, we call it a cold, and this can be caused by lots of different viruses. At the more severe end of that respiratory disease spectrum, it's almost always caused by the influenza virus, which flu itself can cause a mild disease we call the cold, but in its severest form, influenza will cause the disease we commonly know as the flu.
Yep.
And obviously that's a far more severe respiratory illness that involves not only the nose, the throat, but lung symptoms and whole body aches, pains, all the spectrum of really nasty, lousy symptoms we're all familiar with.
Is there a connection between the two? Can a cold become a flu?
Well, yeah, of course. So it can start off as a cold. It can start off as a mild sort of upper, nasally type of illness, but it can, become worse. It can precede another infection. So you might start off with one virus, and often people report they got a bit of a cold, they thought they were getting better, and then a week or so later they start feeling bad again, and this could be a secondary infection. And we know that secondary infections are a real problem with respiratory viruses, whether they're another virus or they can be bacterial. And these secondary infections can often be the real problem in terms of disease.
And we really do simplify it into it's either a cold or it's either a flu, but there's like hundreds of sort of variations of this, right?
Oh, absolutely. So in terms of the major virus that causes the common cold, it's called rhinovirus. So rhino meaning nose.
Meaning rhinoceros is like what rhinoceros. We just put together this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were like, oh, it all makes sense.
Rhino is nose. Easy to remember, okay? So rhinovirus is the common cold virus, and it causes between half and two-thirds of all colds. But it's only one of several viruses that can cause the cold. And indeed, influenza, and there are multiple forms of influenza as well, these generally cause colds too. And there's a whole spectrum of other viruses. But even within the rhinovirus group, there are over 160 subtypes, and they're all distinct in terms of the immune response you need to protect yourself. And that's why you're susceptible to colds throughout your life.
Is that why the flu vaccine is so challenging? Because there are so many ways that you can get sick within this subheading of flu?
Well, of all the hundreds of viruses that cause a cold and or flu, we only have a vaccine that covers four of them.
Right.
Okay, so every year the World Health Organization has to come up with a vaccine that contains three or four representatives of influenza, and this is only influenza. This is not covering rhinovirus or respiratory syncytial virus, or metapneumovirus, adenovirus, coronavirus. There are hundreds of other viruses. This is just one part of the whole spectrum of viruses that can cause a cold and or flu. And for influenza, we can only pick three or four to go into the vaccine. So we have to take a gamble. It's based on what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere in the previous winter. And it's an educated guess. Mm. And sometimes we get it very right. And in other years, we don't get it as right. And that affects the effectiveness of the vaccine.
In saying that, a friend contracted influenza A in the last few weeks. Mm. And she said to the doctors at the hospital, does this mean that the flu vax didn't work? And they said, no, the flu vax probably saved your life because you still had antibodies associated to flu in your system. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's right. So, the flu vaccine is still by far and away the best approach to protecting yourself from influenza, and it's still incredibly effective. And I, support using it, at all age groups throughout life. You need that protection. But as I said, it's not 100% protective. And even if it is partially protective and you get a little bit sick, it's still not as bad as getting fulminant influenza. Yeah. Leading to secondary bacterial sepsis, you know, this can cause all sorts of complications and ongoing disease, which can be extremely life-threatening.
It's 15 minutes away from 10 o'clock. You're listening to ABC Newcastle. I'm Kaya Hadley. Great to be speaking with you on this Tuesday morning. My guest is Associate Professor Nathan Bartlett from the Hunter Medical Research Institute. We're talking colds versus flus. We'll get back to flu and why some people are more susceptible and that idea of secondary infection. But let's go back to colds, because there's a lot at the moment. There's cold remedies everywhere. Wives' tales, aisles of the supermarket are full of it. Do they work?
The short answer is no. All of the medications we have that are designed or advertised at treating a cold are really about just dealing with your symptoms.
Just trying to numb the pain.
Trying to numb the pain, trying to relieve a little bit of the scratchy throat, trying to dry up your sinuses slightly. So just trying to reduce the burden of the symptoms that you're experiencing and make your life a little less miserable. In terms of being antiviral, none of them are targeting the virus itself and have absolutely no impact on the duration of the infection.
So what can we do instead?
Well, I mean, I think the previous conversation you had with Professor Kay Lampkin was extremely relevant to this, because, you know, general health and well-being is one of the best things you can do to improve your immune system and thereby protect yourself from these viruses and reduce the impact they might have in terms of disease. So just look after yourself. Drink less if you're maybe drinking a little bit too much. Look at your diet, exercise. All of these basic lifestyle and health approaches are all going to be really useful and effective at improving your resistance to viruses.
It's about immunity, right?
It's about immunity. And immunity is part of your body systems, and they're all linked. And, you know, general health and well-being are all going to play a part.
We have had really targeted education campaigns as well about how to cough, especially in our youngsters. Anyone who's got young kids knows that the colds, the flus just sort of cycle through the family. Are we seeing those work?
Look, I think so. You know, hand washing, reducing transmission by blocking coughs, these are all going to have an impact. And again, in the absence of any targeted treatments, any antivirals for most of these viruses, that's all we have.
A question's come through on the text around immunity, saying that if you had that, you know, the really bad flu of, say, 2017, does that make you immune for the following year? How does that work?
Yeah, look, it may do. It all depends on the cross-reactivity of the immune response and which virus you were exposed to previously and which one is now potentially going to cause disease. And, you know, there is evidence for cross-subtype protection. So potentially, yes.
You mentioned secondary infection. So do we not actually die of influenza?
Well, we do now because we have antibiotics. But I guess the best example of secondary infections having the biggest impact on a viral respiratory virus disease is the Spanish flu of 1918. Some 500 million people were infected with this virus. Between 20 and 50 million people died, but the vast majority of them died of secondary bacterial pneumonia, not the acute influenza disease itself. And this obviously was in the age of no antibiotics, you know, antibiotics discovered by Sir Alexander Fleming in the mid-1920s. So we were well before the implementation of antibiotics. So it was these secondary, in this case, bacterial pneumonias primarily, that were the main cause of death following influenza.
So it's that your body's immunity is low because you're tackling the flu and the other diseases go, it's free run.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's go.
Absolutely. You've got it in one. It's opportunistic infections. It's acute reduction in your ability to repel other pathogens. And so opportunistic infections like bacteria that are normally on and around your body that don't normally cause you a problem are presented an opportunity through that acute weakening of your lungs and immune system, and they can cause infection.
So what work are you doing in this space?
Yeah, so we're really interested in understanding how we can provide protection against as many of these viruses as possible. As I mentioned, there are literally hundreds of cold-causing viruses that can also cause more severe things like the flu, asthma exacerbations, COPD exacerbations, cystic fibrosis. Anyone with, you know, chronic lung diseases or other, you know, chronic diseases like, you know, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, are all at higher risk of more severe illness as a result of infection with these viruses. So really it's covering as many of these viruses as possible through some kind of therapeutic intervention. And we're developing a drug with a company. It's a joint venture between the University of Melbourne and University of Newcastle. And we're working on a way of boosting your innate immune system. So this is the primary responder in your immune system that before the adaptive response kicks in. And by boosting this, we hope that this will provide some additional protection and really cover you in that window where maybe the vaccine hasn't quite taken hold yet, or you're susceptible because the vaccine has not been given.
So you can target specific elements of our immunity that we know is most at risk at this time of year?
Well, we can target elements of our immunity that we know will boost the protection of your airways to these viruses, and just give you a little bit of an accelerated nudge in terms of mounting an immune response. And we believe that if you can contain and control that infection a little more effectively, it's less likely to get into your lungs. And in the case of, as I said, people with comorbidities like asthma, COPD, and other diseases, then less likely to make that disease worse.
They're in that, we always hear, the high risk category.
Right.
Young, old, those with other conditions.
Indeed, absolutely. So, you know, small children, your risk of these diseases, and the elderly too, where their adaptive immune system is beginning to wane and perhaps those vaccines aren't as effective anymore, this could really help them.
Nathan, was it when you were bedridden with a cold that you thought, hey, this is a good career choice, I might find out more about this? How did you get to this point?
Well, I've always had a fascination with viruses, you know, this arms race between viruses and you know, complex multicellular organisms like people. It's really driven society. It's historically really interesting, but also from a scientific perspective, you know, viruses are very clever beasts, the way they've evolved in order to be successful. So I really found that fascinating as a young scientist, and I was lucky enough to do some work at the Australian Animal Health Laboratories in Geelong, which is a level 4 secure laboratory where they have really nasty viruses like Ebola and anthrax.
You don't want to drop that vial.
No, you don't want to drop that. But that really gave me an insight into how incredibly exciting and interesting viruses are. And really it stemmed from then to get into this field.
Well, interestingly, it is something in medical research that affects literally everyone around the world. It doesn't matter where you are, your race, your colour, your gender, your wealth, everyone is potentially going to be impacted by some of these viruses.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. So the you know, respiratory viruses, particularly cold-causing viruses, are something that links humanity, you know, around the globe. It's the one of the only diseases that we're all will experience in our lifetime and be impacted by.
What are the challenges when you are researching a disease that is constantly evolving?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. And one of the challenges is trying to understand what's driving that evolution,
yeah,
the genetic and molecular processes that underpin that, and then understand how that is then being sensed by our own immune systems and how we can better harness that immune response to deal with those changes in
the
virus.
Not going to let flu be smarter than us for too much longer.
Well, I think it would be a little bit arrogant and naive to believe that we're ever going to be smarter than these viruses, but at least we can try and understand how they're working and maybe keep up with them better.
All right, so tying it in perfectly with our earlier chat, dropping alcohol is a great way to boost immunity. What else can we do to boost immunity? Because I feel like that's another target area that vitamin suppliers and, you know, aisles of supermarkets are dedicated to. But what is the best thing to do to boost immunity to keep ourselves well?
Well, as I said before, I think it's just looking after yourself. It's getting plenty of sleep, rest, trying to reduce the amount of stress in your life. Stress, we know, is a really important factor when it comes to suppressing immunity. Eating well, not drinking too much, just getting all the things we know deep down are the right things to do to look after ourselves, but sometimes we pretend we ignore and that's, you know, when we're more susceptible.
Incredible to find out a little bit more about this. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your knowledge and your work with us this morning.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks, Kai.
That's Associate Professor Nathan Bartlett there from the Hunter Medical Research Institute. We'll catch up with another phenomenal researcher, same time, same place, next week.